Dr. Daniel Wilson, how to build a robot army. All right, let's see whether Dr. Wilson can figure out why. Why don't we just play that bumper, that particular bumper from Herbie Hancock? Dr. Wilson?
That sounds like good breakdancing music to me.
First music video to ever employ robots.
Really?
Yeah. The video to Rocket, if you've never seen it, it was the introduction of robotics in a music video. It was the first time like people had really seen robots dancing or hopping or interacting with each other and in the sort of this makeshift kind of robot band party. It was really cool. You've never seen the video to Rocket?
I don't think I have. I've noticed that robots have appeared in a lot of videos since then. While I was listening to that, I was actually thinking about the last time I tried to break dance when I nearly killed myself trying to do the worm. It was so easy when I was 8.
Well, that was one of three reasons why we played that bumper. The second reason is that the guy who did that song, Herbie Hancock, won for Album of the Year tonight in the Grammys,
which
is
all right.
Amazing after all these years that he's still a player in that way. And also, the third reason being is that even if you and I both had our own robot armies, we still wouldn't be as cool as Herbie Hancock. Still,
I can see this, you know, the robot army marching over the hill and then someone with loudspeakers just plays that song and they all spontaneously break into dance instead of attacking.
Exactly.
Attack robots.
Exactly. To robots, of course, the Herbie Hancock video Rocket is their Thriller.
That's their anthem.
That's the one that they coalesce behind. All right, well, then we'll pick it up here next. How to build a robot army. We were just talking about tips on defending the planet against alien invaders, and we'll talk about ninjas, too, next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Again, if we are to weaponize our domestic robots, say like the Roomba, as discussed in the book, How to Build a Robot Army, it'll take some forethought. Don't want to wait to the last second to try to understand how to do that with your Roomba. Or for that matter, someday your lawnmower or other types of service bots that are coming into our lives. And we're just getting going with a couple of things. Before we get back to the ninjas and the aliens, let's finish up that thing about the exoskeletons, these robotic exoskeletons we're talking about.
Sure. So the whole exoskeleton thing started in the 60s. General Electric created this thing called Hardy Man. And if you Google photos of Hardy Man, H-A-R-D-I-M-A-N, it's really scary and hilarious. There's this guy who's got his arm stuck in what looks like a gigantic, bulky robot arm. You know, it looks like a muscle man. The problem is that it never really worked very well. They were going to use it for moving big pallets and things like that in a factory, kind of like
right.
The robot that Ripley was in.
Right.
And then later, there started being this medical necessity for exoskeletons. So, for instance, there's this guy in the biomechatronics lab at MIT named Hugh Herr. I've seen him give a talk one time. It's really amazing because he actually lost both of his feet in a climbing accident. And as like a really bright guy, he said, you know, forget about it. I'm going to build my own feet. And he did that, and he started experimenting, and he tells like this anecdote where he started increasing his height by an inch every day as he went to class until people noticed. And in his lab, what they've created is probably the hardest to create and somehow most elegant and simple exoskeleton. It's called a passive dynamic exoskeleton, and it's kind of like an extra leg that you wear, and you can't tell it's on there. It's got the exact same human physiological constraints. So you can, it's maybe sitting next to your knee, but it's got a joint where your knee has a joint, and it's got a joint where your hip has a joint. And so you can't tell that it's there whenever you're wiggling your leg, but when you walk, it detects when you're in just the right part of your leg swing where you might need a little extra assistance. And at that point, it gives you a little boost. And so when you wear one of these, it's kind of a get out of the way interface where you move it around just by moving your legs, you can't feel it. And it makes you faster and it makes you stronger. And so they've got a lot of really interesting stuff there. Now, the sexiest exoskeletons are Japanese. There's a company that's really called the Cyberdyne Corporation, which is the company from Terminator. Yeah.
There's a
I know.
Let's stop them now.
I know. And well, to add on to that, they've got an exoskeleton called the HAL 5, which HAL 9000 was the artificial intelligence spaceship.
Sure.
So anyway, the HAL 5 is beautiful. First of all, it's really shiny and polished, and it's this white medical grade looking plastic, and it's a full body exoskeleton, and it uses electromyogram sensors, actually, these little coin sized sensors that go on your skin, and it detects whenever your muscles are exerting. So I think it actually detects electrical energy. And so you can move this thing around, and it actually can tell that you're trying to move it before you push on it. So you don't even have to push on any sensors. And a guy actually used this. It can help you carry 175 pounds or so. And a guy used this to carry another man nearly to the summit of Breithorn Mountain in, I think, Switzerland, pretty sure. But it's pretty amazing, and it actually works. And I think they've produced 5 or 10 of these and put them up for sale. The idea is that you're supposed to be able to use one of these as a medical in the medical profession in order to pick people up out of their wheelchairs and put them in bed.
Right.
This is a really difficult procedure that has to happen a lot.
And it's actually
a dangerous time.
And I've been hearing a little bit about that that goes back to our original conversation about the market driving the technology that there really is a need for with the disproportionate generations. There will be need for more caregivers than there will be human caregivers to use, and that robotics there is going to come into it just for the basic human need of being turned in one's bed.
Yeah, I mean, it's as simple as that. And the other thing is that you can replace all the intelligence that's required to figure out who needs to be picked up, whether they're okay. All of that stuff, you can just replace that by having a human being that is inside the suit. So you just put the suit onto a caregiver rather than try to create a robot from scratch that can do all of that. And, of course, another big need for exoskeletons is in warfare. So there are a couple of DARPA-funded exoskeleton programs, which are both bearing fruit. They've been around. These programs are around for several years while people work on them. So when you hear about them at first, you go, oh, my God, they're really building that? And then you go and look, right, and you say, well, they just managed to get the grant money. They haven't produced anything. Well, both of these projects have actually produced prototypes that work. And one's at Berkeley, UC Berkeley. They got the Bleaks, the Berkeley Lower Extremity Exoskeleton. This thing's really neat. It's got these hollow tubes with all the machinery inside, and it only fits on from your hips down, and then it has kind of a piece that sticks up that holds a backpack. There's no arms or anything. So you kind of just strap your legs into its legs, and it's electric, and you just get going. The backpack can hold about 100 pounds, I think. And the interesting thing about this is you can, and I've seen video, you can squat down, you can dance, you can hop around, and it works. It balances itself the whole time. Kind of like being on a Segway, it's tough to make a Segway fall over.
Well,
no matter how much you lean.
I'm looking at what you're saying, though, too, and I'm reminded that for people who have lost lower extremities, like in the case of feet and athletes, mm-hmm. that it's really the low-tech exoskeletons that have become kind of the gold standard. Those very high-tech designs that essentially look like prongs off the bottom of the knees or the shins. And I'd like to see and I say this with great sincerity, I'd like to see a race between a normally abled human, somebody who has been abled with these low-tech, high-design but low-tech extremities, and then robot extremities.
Ooh, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about that. So there has been something going on recently. The Olympics are the biggest worldwide sporting event that ever on the planet, right? And they happen every 4 years. Well, what a lot of people don't know is that after the Olympics are over, they wait a couple weeks, and then they hold the Paralympics, and that's the second biggest sporting event ever that nobody seems to know about. And one of the champion sprinters in the Paralympics is a guy named Oscar Pistorius, And he runs on what you're describing. He's missing both of his, since birth, he's been missing both of his feet from about the knee down, a little bit further down from the knee. And so he runs on these things called cheetah blades. And yeah, they're not complicated. There's, in fact, I don't think there's any sensing or anything that's happening. They're just carbon fiber blades shaped like upside down question marks. And they have 95% of the energy you put into them comes back, just like a couple springs, you know?
Which is much more than our natural extremities give
us. Much better than a foot does.
Right.
Incidentally, I called the cheetah manufacturers for something for this. And they said that, although they wouldn't go on record, when these things fail, they just explode.
Oh, no.
So they just go pow, and they just spray pieces
like
of carbon fiber.
The synthetic material?
Over.
I'll be darned.
But you know, kind of like a car tire blower or something. But,
right.
You know, I don't assume it's too bad, but pretty dramatic. But they won't. He's been trying to get into the Olympics, and they won't let him.
Of course.
And
he'll have the advantage.
Of course.
He'll beat them.
Yeah, and the thing is, he'll beat them, and it's they say it's because of the technology that he'll beat them. You know, but
well, whether it's because he's got the lionized heart of a great athlete or because of the technology, he'll still beat them. And you it only makes sense when you look at how much energy is returned through those essentially what are high tech springs.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a slippery slope when you start to think about it because. For instance, I'm living out in Portland, Oregon right now, where Nike started out here, and it started because a track coach was trying to improve the shoes that his athletes were wearing. And that's technology that goes on your foot and literally makes you faster. You can wear one pair of shoes and go faster than another guy that's the same as you who's wearing, you know, weaker shoes. So, you know, you think about the technology there, and you think about how they're wearing clothes and they're got training approaches that, you know, they train just right so that they'll be perfect. It's pretty crazy, but here's the end result on this whole thing.
Yeah, but wait. I'm going to back you up on that. But I think the difference between that is everybody has access to those shoes. Not everybody would have access to those legs.
Without cutting their legs off.
Yeah, and I think that's the equalizer. And you can get a sponsor and buy a suit.
You're right.
You know, but you can't. Right. You know, you start then mutilating yourself, and that may be what I'm serious. They're worried about is that athletes would start to mutilate themselves in order to get those springs, in order to get those records.
Yeah. If you want to look at them, males and females don't compete in the same events. and if you wanted to, you'd have to undergo some severe surgery in order to switch events.
Right.
So it does make sense. And even in the Paralympics, they have events for people who are missing one leg, events for people who are paraplegic, who can't walk at all, and they have to do the race in wheelchairs generally. So, you know, that way you do make it, to some extent, you want the Olympics to be about the heart, the lionized heart, as you describe it, and not about the technology. You know,
well,
they used to be naked, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's what they ought to go back to, by the way. And I think they could sell it on pay-per-view, and I think it could be a huge event.
Well, but anyway, my view on that, just real quick, is that the Paralympics are going to be more fun to watch than the Olympics really soon when they start going faster than humans.
I think you're exactly right. And I think that's the interesting thing about that type of competition, though, is what if you pulled aside the winner, kind of like a Super Bowl, like used to be between the winner of the NFL and the AFL, and then you played the Super Bowl. What if you took the winner of the Paralympics and you set them against the same events? Yeah, and that's a huge pay-per-view. I think that'd be very cool. In fact, it's a little bit like having regular Wile E. Coyote chasing after the Roadrunner, Wile E. Coyote on Big Giant Acme Springs, and Wile E. Coyote wearing like rocket boots and seeing which one would win.
I would go on record agreeing with you that that's going to occur within, I would say that's going to occur within 10 years.
I think that'd be very cool.
Pistorius is not faster than the fastest human sprinter. Not yet. So
that's just part of the exoskeleton robotic story, but not all about on how to build a robot army. So let's get back to the idea about defending the planet against ninjas. Now, are we to assume from that this is a reference to our current economy and the reason why a lot of the East, where we should be worried about invasion from our Asian economic overlords or something, that they're going to send in the ninjas?
You've overestimated how deep I am.
Okay.
So the book is really a venue to explain robots. And with ninjas, I strictly take the pop culture idea of a ninja, and that's what I'm imagining that the robots are going to have to fight. So it's almost like thinking about the robots are going to have to fight Chuck Norris, or they're going to have to fight a great white shark, or whatever, you know.
I'd like to see Chuck Norris versus a great white shark, by the way.
Yeah.
I'd pay for that, too. I'd pay
for
it.
Robot referee or something.
Maybe. Yeah, we can make that a twofer with the other race for $39.95.
Man, I'd pay it.
So, with two.
So with a ninja, the joke, the running joke with ninjas is that only a ninja can defeat another ninja, and that ninjas are really sneaky. So the idea with a ninja is that you would have to have a robot ninja that could fight. And so then it becomes interesting to consider, how do you teach a robot, you know, to be a ninja? How do you teach it martial arts? So that's really an interesting question from a robotics perspective. So this gives me a chance to talk about commanding robot troops and how to, for instance, learning by demonstration is really interesting. I talk a little bit about it. For a robot, a lot of times they don't have the exact same form factor that a human being has. You know, they might have extra arms, or they might not have a head or something like that. Sometimes they have lots and lots of legs or no legs, wheels, whatever. When you learn by demonstration, that's defined as watching somebody do it and then doing it yourself. And so I get to talk a little bit about watching a person and then developing a control policy, which is just a set of instructions that are going to replicate what that person just did, that are going to solve what's called the correspondence problem, where you work out a correspondence between another person's, somebody else's body and your own possibly pretty crazy robot body. So really, that's where the ninja stuff, that lets me explain that. And also, you know, I get to joke around about ninjas, which is pretty
fun. Very cool. But I mean, I think that's the interesting part, is that you are looking at that in kind of a whole another way of imagining weaponry, too, because then it's one thing if you're taking a robot weapon that can fire versus either a person or another, you know, type of mechanical device that can fire. That's one thing. But if you are going at a purely kind of human military dynamic where they're never going to fire, but they're sneaky, and that they use a high amount of human cunning. Yeah. That you have to find a way to have a robot that can outsmart the human cunning. And how far away are we talking about before you can have a robot that can actually do that?
Robots, well, they can be arbitrarily tricky, I think. A lot of it, though, has to do with how tricky the human is that programmed it. That's interesting, because almost always roboticists are trying to make robots that are really easy to understand and very, very predictable. That's what you want your robot to be. In fact, you know, recently an automated anti-aircraft gun, which is essentially a robot, it killed a bunch of people. It killed 9 people in South Africa, its handlers, and it was because it behaved erratically and started shooting when it shouldn't have. So even the dangerous robots, you want to make sure they're predictable.
Right.
So, but I want to push some time, because no one's trying to make robots that are cunning.
Sure, but at the same time, if you're going to have a robot that could take on, say, something like a ninja, you'd have to build into it a kind of fuzzy logic. At least that's what it seems to me. We'll come back with that thought, and then we'll get to our final scenario, and the one that I'm enjoying the most, the alien invaders, how to build a robot army to help defend the planet Earth against alien invaders. We'll talk about that with robot expert Dr. Daniel Wilson on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. We're talking about robots tonight with the robot expert, Dr. Daniel Wilson. His new book is very informative, How to Build a Robot Army, essentially how to weaponize the simple robots that will or already are in our life against a possible invasion. In this case, we'll talk about what you do. How would you program robots to take on an alien invasion? And we'll get down to cases on that. Plus, wrap up a couple other things before we get to your calls and your comments. You can join the conversation about both the concepts that exist for robots and what concepts have really perhaps yet to be considered. We'll get to that all next hour. But first, Dr. Daniel Wilson next to talk about the impending alien invasion. Look out, Canadians, on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Dr. Daniel Wilson, let's continue to go back to this ninja thing for the moment, because I think that by trying to imagine robots being armed to take on a ninja attack, it does push perhaps more than it does with some of the other subjects, the need for imprecise logic or fuzzy logic built into the system in order for them to defeat something which is as humanly based as like a hand-to-hand combat with ninjas.
Well, it would have to be capable of choosing a lot of different behaviors. That's for sure. In fact, you know, I think it would be better, though, to just build the robot in the first place, maybe not even tell the robot about all of its tricks, and just put a bomb in it or something like that, so that when no one expects it, it just wipes out both the combatants.
And that may be the way to do it, but I do think this is one of those things about robots which seem to be the most challenging, would you be to create and to try to outfox a human, would be the necessity of creating levels of sub-ranges or levels of subsets of thinking that they would have to switch back and forth from, kind of like how a dishwasher would decide, you know, whether it's a heavy load or a light load, or whether there's a lot of gunk in the water or whatever the sensors are in a dishwasher, that robot would have to make these instantaneous decisions between what is being thrown at it and what it would have to choose as a way of fighting back with.
Yeah, it's almost like a chess game that occurs. It's like a no-holds-barred chess game. Robots are actually pretty good at chess. They can look forward because the rules are really constrained. They know exactly what moves they can choose and what moves the other person can choose. And it's really where humans shine is when you take away all the rules and it's just us and them, you can, as a person, make more general purpose decisions and make higher level decisions than a robot generally can. I mean, if you look at the Terminator, you know, it's really good at trying to kill people, but ultimately it's a robot and it just keeps attacking no matter what. And so what they do is, I mean, they know that it's going to come toward them because it's trying to kill them, and it eventually drags itself right underneath that press. And they hit the button and they squish it. So
right.
It's because they could predict what the robot was going to do. And
that was its ultimate downfall in that way. Right. Oh, I totally get that. And that's why I think that's why it's interesting for me to think about something which, even to a human, which has some parity with the mind of the ninja, the average human, the average person would be completely caught off guard by the number of potential moves or offenses or defenses, for that matter, offered by a ninja.
Yeah, you'd have to have a ninja train the robot in the first place. And
right.
That's in robotics, that's called a domain expert. So if you're training a robot to do anything, if you're training it to chop celery, then you bring in a domain expert to teach it that. So it would definitely need a master, just like a human would.
Yeah, and we go back to, I guess, who would build it then, and if they're ninjas, it would be that Cyberdyne company in Japan, right?
That would be my first bet, anybody that's going to name their company that.
Yeah, I wonder if they've ever contacted Arnold Schwarzenegger and tried to get him to be their company spokesperson.
That would be
Japan.
Interesting to know. I wonder if he probably gets emails like that all the time.
Or whether if Cyberdyne Robotics in Japan has a competitor, whether they've ever tried to hire Linda Hamilton as their spokesperson.
Yeah, she's, her latest incarnation is still running away from Terminators now in the new Terminator television show.
I guess you're right.
Sarah Connor. I had a good Schwarzenegger to blurb my book for me. That would be great.
That would be very cool. Actually, you're exactly right. You should have tried that.
I never
Well, you've got another book, I'm sure, coming in the back of your mind. About robots. All right, so on to the third application of how to build a robot army. What do we learn from building a robot army versus alien invaders?
So when I was thinking about this, it's really wide open. I mean, there are so many different accounts of what alien invaders would look like. And so I chose to go with the most generic sort of Hollywood explanation of what the alien invasion looks like. So I make a couple jokes about how you need to protect your monuments because the aliens always
seem to go after monuments. That's right.
And I also, so it's really wide open. You don't know what it's going to look like. So I assume that there would be spaceships. And so I talk a little bit about using existing anti-satellite technology, which is already out there. I think there are about three different types of technologies that the United States uses to get rid of satellites or to potentially get rid of satellites in the future. They use missiles. They use armed satellites that have weapons built in. And they have kamikaze satellites that just can be guided so that they run into another satellite or get close enough to another satellite before they explode. So you'd want to use all those, first of all, but they'd probably be useless since this is advanced alien technology. So I kind of went back to the roots and went with an H.G. Wells War of the Worlds kind of approach, but updated. And that means infecting the alien invaders, but not with regular old germs, because maybe they learned from that movie, but infecting them with nanorobots or micro-robots that are small enough that they're the size of a germ or the size of bacteria. And so this was fun because I got to talk about the current research that's going into nanorobots. You know, it's really interesting.
Well, and so talk about that because by the way, your point on the monuments is actually a really good one, and I never really thought about it, but that's exactly what we do. I mean, anytime, and we've projected that the aliens would do it too, but we went after, when you go, there's so much, sort of that big moment of defining the fact that you're a conqueror. We pulled down with the help of the people, we assisted in the pulling down of the statue of Saddam Hussein, or blowing up the stone swastika at the end of World War II, where that sort of signified the Nazis are done, or whatever. I mean, we do that kind of monument tearing down. Why wouldn't we think that the invading aliens would too?
We really do. Yeah, that's an interesting point. But when you think about it, those moves are usually symbolic, and they usually happen after after the fighting, and what those moves symbolize is the downfall of a regime, and which what that says to me is when the aliens are attacking, you're not going to want to hang out with, like, the president or...
Right, exactly.
Because, yeah, they're going to be at major risk. But on to nanorobots. While I was doing research for this book, I ended up talking to this fascinating guy named Metin City, who's at Carnegie Mellon, and he runs the nano robotics laboratory there. Laboratory.
You sound like Dexter.
Yeah, I spend a lot of time trying not to sound like Dexter because it's maybe my natural. So he showed me a lot of his robots that he's got, and this is the guy who came up with the nanotechnology that reproduces the fibers that are on the gecko palms, these lizards that can climb up walls and things like that. I talk about that a little bit in Robot Uprising. So what he's got are these robots that are small enough to locomote in the renal system. So this is what his problem is he's trying to send robots into the urinary tract.
Right.
And this is an environment where, you know, it's like Fantastic Voyage. Everything's shrunk down, and so all the rules are off about using regular locomotion techniques. You know, you can't swim because the fluid is so viscous. So this is what roboticists do again and again. You look at that environment. You say, I haven't got any idea on how I could build something that could locomote in that environment. And so you go out and you find whatever biological solution exists to that problem, and you find whatever creatures live there. And on this scale, it's bacteria. And they tend to use flagella and cilia, which are just, the flagella is just like the tail on a spermatozoa, and cilia are just shorter versions of that in greater numbers.
Well, it would be like creating little robot rowboats, right?
Yeah. To some extent.
I think of that, and I picture the Viking ships with all of the oars in the water at the same time. I mean, that's what you got with flagellum, right? I mean,
well, the flagella is more like a tail that curls up and then wiggles.
Oh, that's right. Sorry.
Yeah, but he does But he does have another robot that does travel just the way you're talking about. But I will talk for hours about robots. Let me try to just get this one out.
Sorry.
So what he did was he invented a really tiny robot that has a synthetic flagella on the back end, and it rotates like a kind of like a corkscrew, and it pushes it through the renal system. Now, here's what's really crazy. He went one step further, and he realized that you can actually use the bacteria themselves. You don't have to build your own version of a flagella whenever you've got a flagella right there. So he essentially built a robot that, like a horse will hitch up to a wagon, a bacteria hitches up to a tiny robot, and the bacteria, when it's exposed, well, first of all, you have to buy a non-pathogenic bacteria that's not going to spread disease.
Right.
And then you build a robot that you want, and you dip it in these chemicals that are attractive to the bacteria, and then you dip the robot into Microbe City for 5 minutes. You pull it out, and it's got these bacteria with flagella on it. And then what happens is the robot can put out certain chemicals that excite the bacteria or put the bacteria to sleep. And that's kind of like the gas and the brakes. And he's really done this, you know. This is just blows me away that this is real.
And of course, I think many of us harken back to, you know, all of the movies about, you know, the going into the human body and
right.
using these little. So, but what can it actually do once it's there? I mean, how, what kind of intelligence, what kind of logic is being applied to get it to be helpful, not just to get through, but
right.
to make a difference in being there?
Well, for human beings, it's designed to get rid of blockages, I think. So it can carry, for the first thing it can do is it can just carry sensory equipment. So it can radio out. Now, it's not doing this yet. I mean, there's a lot of miniaturization that's going to have to happen and stuff like that. The idea is to see, with his researchers, is just to see whether you can locomote, whether you can get around. And in fact, it goes 10 times faster than an E. coli bacteria, which is
Whoa.
Kind of interesting and gross.
Yeah, really.
So you can sense what's going on and send out information. They have camera pills that you can swallow that do something kind of like that. And then it, you could also have it so that it destroys a blockage or gets rid of something. And the idea is it doesn't have to come back. It just, can just be a one-way mission, because once you don't feed the bacteria for a long enough time, they just die and your body naturally just clears out the nanorobot. Now, they could also be loaded with poison or loaded with something that's going to attack an alien entity. So it's an interesting approach.
Yeah, and again, since we can't really define what an alien entity would be like, because we
right.
don't, if that's sort of by nature of them being
Hopefully
aliens.
Be filled with vessels.
We'd like to think, but you know, who knows? Maybe they'll send their robots like we've seen in other movies. Then we're stuck. We'd have all these biotech weapons, but we would have no bio parts to use them on.
There's a really funny part in Futurama where these robots are all scared of humans. And at the end, they say, the human was impervious to our strongest electromagnetic attacks, and yet it succumbed when we poked it with this simple stick. Because
right.
the robots are all obviously impervious to being stabbed. They don't even
right.
consider it as something dangerous. So, yeah, actually, in this section, I do talk also a lot about some of the robots that are used for collecting information. We already talked about the micro-air vehicles, but getting intel is really key. It's funny, in movies, you know, like Men in Black, or no, I'm sorry, Independence Day, when they go into the alien ship and they can just breathe the atmosphere, you know, it's like, oh, so all these aliens happen to breathe oxygen. That's nice. I don't think you could really make those kinds of assumptions in real
right.
life. You might want to send a robot in to figure out what the atmosphere is like. And luckily, a lot of robots are designed to do that, robots that are used to explore other planets and things like
well,
that.
And I was thinking about that a little bit. Do we have any knowledge, when I was reading your book, of having weaponized any of these robots which we have sent to other planets? I mean, do any of them have any defensive system whatsoever?
Oh, and absolutely not. No. They're so stripped down that they only have the absolute necessary items on there. And as it turns out, generally, what happens is each of these robots, and even just much less trips all the way to Mars or to the moon or to other planets, just going into space, just going into orbit to the in National Space Station, huge competition over whose science experiments actually see, zero gravity. People are constantly, there's a huge waiting list, and people are just, there's a huge competition to determine which science experiments go up. So I would really doubt that any of those are weaponized. But then again, they can't, as we've shown with the Mars rovers, they can be used, sometimes they can get creative about how they use what they've got, you know. So maybe if one of them had some kind of laser to vaporize rock so that it could sample the rock, and the laser could be used or the drill could be used, but those guys are meek as kittens. They sleep most of the time.
Do they? And is there a self-destruct mechanism on any of those robots?
No. One thing that they are really worried about is whether these robots are carrying microbes into space. Oh, ooh, one of my favorite, this is not doesn't have to do necessarily with robotics, but one of my favorite experiments is this thing called the tardigrade experiment. Have you heard of this?
No, I don't know anything about it. Go ahead.
Okay, so a tardigrade is a type of animal that's about the size of the tip of a pin, like P-I-N. And it's this little roly-poly looking guy. And these things are they're the toughest creature on Earth, pretty much, for their size. They can survive in a vacuum. They can survive super levels of heat and levels of cold. And so this experiment is all about taking tardigrades and just putting them in space and seeing if they can live. And this kind of shows a potential problem with sending probes and things to other planets is, what if we end up seeding this planet on accident with a bunch of animals that can actually live there or reproduce or completely change this environment? Well, that's the other thing. When you go into orbit, you get hit with a lot of UV, and that really greatly increases the amount of mutations that happen. And so, things evolve quicker in space. They die a lot more, but they evolve quicker.
Who's overseeing that to either make sure that it isn't happening, or that if it is happening, we're not told about it? That who's involved with those kind of decisions about human bacteria ending up in space?
Well, so that's going to be NASA's mandate, and something that I think that they're really motivated to make sure that these things are totally clean when they go to other planets, because all these guys that work at NASA and ladies are nerds, and they all want to know whether there's life in outer space, and they don't want to screw up the sample. You know, you don't want to get your rock sample back and say, oh, it's life, and then say, oh, it's a bunch of tardigrades that escaped from a science project.
But I wonder if anybody's ever sent up, like a canary in the coal mine or something, sent up bacteria in a little biosphere and left it on, say, the surface of Mars or the moon or whatever, just to come back to it 5 years later and find out what happened.
That would be a pretty interesting experiment. I'm pretty sure that by recording conditions on Mars, they can pretty much recreate what it's like to be on Mars here on Earth. So it's more likely to occur here on Earth than there. But
all right, we'll leave it there for now. All right, now this is the part where everybody gets to jump in. We'll give you all the numbers you need. How to build a robot army, tips on defending planet Earth against alien invaders, ninjas, and zombies. It's the latest book by Dr. Daniel Wilson, also the author of How to Survive a Robot Uprising and Where's My Jetpack, next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.